You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the general that led the Mali coup apologizes to the nation. Meanwhile, thousands of soldiers for the United Nations are poised to take up residence in preparation for upcoming elections.
Also coming up on the show, it was one of the 20th century's most vicious acts of genocide. We speak to the filmmaker behind a new documentary about Indonesia's failed coup in 1965 and the bloody reprisals that followed.
Try filming the perpetrators. They will tell you what happened and they will boast about it. And in their boasting, the audience will see exactly why we're so afraid. It is terrifying to live amongst the people who've killed your relatives and are boasting to you about how they did it.
Also, we meet an artist who wants to create a brand new and world-class art school on the English Anglian coast.
The opportunity to become professional artists so they don't have to teach and do other jobs. They can, you know, make their money making arts. It's a bit like art heaven.
All that, plus we spin some fantastic tunes too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
A busy hour ahead, but let's catch up on the world news headlines now with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The United States is coming under increasing pressure to respond to reports that it spied on European Union offices in America. Citing papers leaked by the whistleblower Edward Snowden, the German magazine Der Spiegel is claiming that offices in New York and Washington were targeted, along with the French, German and Italian embassies. The president of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, is demanding an explanation.
I will ask them, is it true? Why no explanation from your side? Or in case it is true, what is the justification? And after we have the justification or no comment, we can discuss about consequences.
Officials in Arizona say at least 19 firefighters have been killed while battling a wildfire around 80 miles northwest of Phoenix. They were part of a specialist unit which has tackled other wildfires in Arizona and New Mexico in recent weeks. It's the highest death toll for firefighters in a single incident since the 9/11 terror attacks in 2001. Arizona Senator John McCain said it was a devastating loss which served as a reminder of the grave risks which firefighters face every day. Croatia has become the 28th member of the European Union. Their membership began at midnight on Sunday with huge crowds joining celebrations in the streets of the capital Zagreb. The nation of 4.4 million people faces significant problems with an unemployment rate of 18%, almost double the EU average. But President Ivo Josipovic described the event as a historic and a great and joyful day. Croatia applied for EU membership 10 years ago, and it's the first new member since Romania and Bulgaria joined the Union in 2007. The President of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, congratulated the country on its new status.
It is truly an historic moment for Croatia, for your government, for the citizens of your country. You have always been European. You are now a full member of our European Union. This means new opportunities, but also new responsibilities.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry has been meeting his Southeast Asian counterparts at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations conference in Brunei. With a number of territorial disputes between member nations continuing to rumble on, Mr. Kerry said the US did not wish to take sides, but was in favour of introducing a code of conduct for the region.
While we do not take a position on a competing territorial claim over land features, we have a strong interest in the manner in which the disputes of the South China Sea are addressed and in the conduct of the parties. We very much hope to see progress soon on a substantive code of conduct in order to help ensure stability in this vital region.
Demonstrators clashed with police outside Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium last night as the Confederations Cup final between Brazil and Spain was getting underway. Protesters marching on the stadium were confronted by police who used tear gas to disperse them. Some demonstrators answered back by hurling rocks and Molotov cocktails at police dressed in riot gear. Inside the stadium, Brazil beat the reigning world champion Spain 3-0. A Chinese bank has taken first place in a survey of the world's top 1,000 banks. The annual survey by The Banker placed the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China at the top of the list, up from third a year ago. JP Morgan stayed in second place, with last year's winner Bank of America falling to third. The survey is based on a bank's Tier 1 capital, a key indicator of its strength. ICBC saw its capital rise by 15% to $160.6 billion. HSBC was the only British bank in the top 10. China now has four in the top 10 and 96 in the top 1,000. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney. We'll see you in about half an hour. It's 5 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Well, we start today with Fiona Wilson, our agenda setter this hour. And of course, she is also Monocle's Tokyo bureau chief. Welcome to you, Fiona.
Hello there. Good afternoon from Tokyo.
Good afternoon. Good morning from us here in London. What have you got for us today?
Well, there's been a rather interesting news. It actually came through London. The Guardian has been reporting that this is more on the Edward Snowden story, that US intelligence was spying not just on the people it didn't like, but also on its allies, including Japan. It's been spying on 38 missions and embassies, including the Japanese embassy in Washington, which I think came as a bit of a surprise here.
Did it really come as a surprise?
Well, I think publicly they have to say, make all the right noises. Of course, you don't know what goes on behind the scenes. It's certainly very embarrassing because obviously, you know, Japan and US have a very tight relationship, and it makes Japan look rather vulnerable in that situation. And it doesn't put the US in a good light. And the chief cabinet secretary, Mr. Suga, has been saying that it's looking to clarify the story through its diplomatic channels.
So here in Europe, they've demanded apologies if the story turns out to be true. I mean, is Japan demanding apologies, or are they going about it slightly more diplomatically?
Much more diplomatically. There's been no talk of outrage yet. I think that they're reacting to the news. It's come out now, so they have to be seen to be reacting. But I think overall, you know, Japan and the US, you know, they're very cozy. They don't want any disruption in that relationship, particularly at the moment with all the issues going on with China. They want to be seen to be very close.
Give us a sense of the extent of what we know so far about how this mission has actually gone about. Well, what sort of means and methods have the US been using in Japan?
Well, actually, it's in the U.S. It's the embassy in the U.S. that they've been bugging. The sort of details have been coming out that were not specific to the Japanese embassy, but just generally, they seemed rather old fashioned. You know, putting a bug in a commercially available fax seems fairly straightforward, actually. You know, nothing too 007 about it. But you know, I think it's just an embarrassment. It continues to heap embarrassment on the US in this part of the world where it's done so much damage to its image. You know, in Japan, it has a very strong image. It's quite robust here, but certainly China, Hong Kong, absolutely disastrous.
Fiona, just before we move on, any idea of exactly what type of content or information they were trying to gather?
No, nothing's been revealed about Japan, actually, so far. This is, you know, at the moment, it's really just about communication, what was going in and out of the embassies. There's been nothing specific that's been said, you know, and quite frankly, I would expect the US to know much of what's going on with Japan anyway.
Fiona, let's move on to Japan, China and South Korea. Their foreign ministers are meeting for the first time. Tell us more about this meeting.
Yes, well, the ASEAN, the Southeast Asian Nations Association, is meeting in Brunei at the moment. And it's actually ASEAN plus three, because you have Japan, China and South Korea, obviously three enormous players in this part of the world. They've been tacked on to the meeting, as always. And it's just been very interesting because these three foreign ministers for these three countries have not met. Each country has had a new government and these three have not met. And obviously tensions are extremely high between these countries. So everyone was scrutinising the photo session yesterday, which was open to the press to see who spoke to whom. And it was noted that while the Japanese and South Korean foreign ministers talked, the Japanese and Chinese foreign minister did not talk. So that a lot was read into that, about the frostiness of relations.
Has anything come out of this so far? Have they tried to at least put forth a united front, or are they still just getting to know each other?
I think they're getting to know each other. I mean, you know, obviously statements are going to be coming out as joint statements. So bilateral decisions would come, you know, separately, in fact. But I think that in association with this, China has been slightly upping the pressure on Japan to hold a summit. They want Japan to acknowledge that there is a territorial dispute over the Senkaku. Hard to believe it, but Japan still doesn't say there is a dispute. They just say, no, this is Japanese territory, end of discussion. So China's using this as an opportunity to remind people that there is an issue there. You know, and also you've got the issue over North Korea. Japan wants to see a bit more action there. They want to see, you know, North Korea conforming to all the UN resolutions. And that's an indirect way of speaking to China and saying, come on, China, you need to put pressure on North Korea.
Tell us more about this plan to create a single market, 3 billion people, the biggest trading base. That would be so significant.
Well, I mean, you know, it already exists, obviously, but they're signing a series of free trade agreements, and it makes perfect sense. Already, these 13 countries are huge trading partners anyway. They're really significant. I mean, ASEAN, they were saying that the trade with the plus three countries, Japan, China and South Korea, is more than a quarter of their trade. So it's already very, very significant. This just really opens the doors, brings down the barriers, and, you know, it keeps everyone happy. And I think also it just shows Asia, you know, being a bit more confident and making its own agreements. It doesn't always depend on agreements with the rest of the world.
Fiona, the official agenda lists all of the sort of, you know, big picture things, finance, trade, etc. But the topic of food security is also on the list. Is that really high up their priority list?
Well, I mean, food security is always a big issue. It's issues about rice, pricing of rice. You know, Japan certainly has issues around security. Japan is not a self-sufficient country. If you look at the facts and figures, it's quite interesting to see Japan depends on other places for its mineral resources. And, you know, really, there has to be these agreements have to be in place. So this is not just a sort of talking shop. This is quite significant. This meeting is, you know, serious issues are decided here.
Fiona, let's move on to the new Australia Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. He's unveiled his new cabinet lineup. Any surprises
yes.
there?
Well, I mean, you know, the big headline, and he, of course, I'm sure he was looking for a headline, is that there are more women than there have ever been in an Australian cabinet. It's gone up to 11.
He kind of had to do that, though, didn't he, having ousted the first woman?
He certainly did. I mean, I have to admire any woman who would go into Australian politics after the absolute mauling Julia Gillard received. So I think, obviously, Kevin Rudd doesn't want to look like the bad guy, pushed out the woman, and he's showing, no, I'm not sexist. I love women. You know, here are 11 of them in my cabinet. So, yeah, I think it's very tactical. Obviously, he said, you know, of course, it's all on merit, not gender. But I think few people would see it quite that way. You have to be a bit cynical.
He's not exactly all change, is it? Because he's been around for ages and it's been a tussle between the two. So, I mean, how do you think people are really viewing this quote-unquote change in government? Are they slightly sceptical?
Sorry for Julia Gillard, but the polls suggest that they're pretty delighted with the change in leadership. I'm afraid, you know, that she was trailing Tony Abbott, the opposition leader. The election's coming up. The date is now a bit uncertain. It was going to be the middle of September, but Kevin Rudd said he's not happy with that date, but he hasn't offered an alternative date, much to the annoyance of the Conservative opposition. But at the moment, Kevin Rudd is a poll they had in the Australian yesterday put him, I think, you know, 51% of people preferred him as prime minister, well ahead of Tony Abbott. So that, you know,
is that just the sort of bounce that we often see when a change like this takes place, or is that sustainable?
Yeah, you do often see, but I mean, the election is very, very close. You know, so a change of government might, of course, you'd expect a bounce, but then you could be talking about a general election 3 years away. In this case, you're talking about a general election. It could be, you know, any time from mid-August. People are thinking likely to be October, but it's not far away. So if Kevin Rudd could just hold on to that nice bounce, you know, he could be a winner. It's very difficult to say. The polls are really, really close at the moment between the two parties. So it would be a case of pretty much fighting tooth and nail over the next few weeks.
I think we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Fiona. That was Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, setting the agenda for us today. Coming up, we head to the Malian capital, Bamako, as the UN prepares to take over peacekeeping operations there. That's right after this, so stay with us.
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? Different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburger Nockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a Falooda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's The Menu, in association with Krug.
It's been just over a year now since the conflict in Mali erupted that brought about the ousting of the president. Now, the United Nations Security Council has agreed to deploy a peacekeeping force there, starting today. That force will be led by Rwandan General Kazura, formerly second in command of African Union troops in Sudan's western Darfur region. The aim of all this, of course, is to provide stability and security for the upcoming elections.
Following a rehatting ceremony today in which soldiers will replace their headgear with the distinctive pale blue berets of the UN, a peacekeeping force of what will eventually number around 12,600 soldiers, mostly West African, will take over security duties from the French, who will keep up to 1,000 troops in the country. The mission in Mali, known as MINUSMA, will be the third largest UN peacekeeping operation once it reaches full capacity by the end of the year. And joining us now to discuss what lies ahead for Mali and its intended election at the end of this month is our woman in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith. Alex, good morning. Welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How significant is this then as a peacekeeping force?
Well, I think it's significant, as you say, it's the third largest in the world. And it's significant also that Mali's been given the attention of the Security Council to switch from an African Union force, a weaker African Union force, a West African force, to a more global international UN force, which actually has quite a lot of offers for troops, even though the numbers aren't up to the 12,000 figure you mentioned. Today it'll start at the 6,000 figure. They're actually soldiers who are here already. And then they will gradually be increasing in number until the end of the year. The UN, of course, brings with it a certain number of other possibilities, such as political reform, election support, various issues that the African Union doesn't have the capacity or the money to address. So I think it's a great help for Mali that the UN has taken such an interest and is willing to give the country such a large force.
Alex, what do we know about the man who will lead this 1,000-strong force, the Rwandan General Kazura?
Well, Jean Bosco Kazura is very, very interesting indeed. Not only is he a routine peacekeeper, but quite ironically, and as you mentioned, you know, this has been a place where the French have been very present since January. He's going to be running the show with a head of staff, head of army staff, who was in Rwanda during the genocide. They were on opposite sides. The Frenchman was serving in the government of Habyarimana, the president who was killed just when the genocide started in Rwanda, and Jean Bosco Kazura was in the rebels entering the country alongside Paul Kagame from Uganda. So there's a little bit of an element of the French reconciliation with Rwanda happening here in Mali.
Alex, just tell us more about who's making up this contingent. They're obviously mostly African mission soldiers. One of the problems, though, potentially, is that Chad will be making up a big amount of the soldiers. Tell us more, because obviously they are sort of blacklisted and being monitored because of their use of child soldiers.
Yes, because of their use of child soldiers now, they've signed up to an action plan. And I was talking to Bert Krunders, who is the head of the UN peacekeeping force here. And he was saying, well, actually, probably at the end of the day, the experience will have been a positive one, because Chad has now had to look at itself, pledge not to send child soldiers into the UN mission, and also review its policy of recruiting child soldiers. The countries otherwise represented here are mostly West African, and also more widely, China is sending peacekeepers, for example, and Sweden has recently pledged to.
Alex, I mean, you're there on the ground. What is the feeling about these elections that are planned for the 28th of this month? Optimistic that they'll come to pass and in relative security?
I think there are a lot of worries over the elections. The elections are happening because essentially the international community can't do business with a transitional government that's unelected, and that's the situation Mali is in at the moment. So they're pushing very hard for these elections. But the country isn't entirely secure. We've got this UN force coming into force today, beginning its work today. It's got 4 weeks until election day to convince Malians that this is a force to be reckoned with. This is, in fact, a force not to mess with, and this is a force that's going to secure these elections. And I don't know, with the best will in the world and the strongest mandate in the world, which this force does have a good mandate, I still don't know if the UN has quite the credibility of, for example, the French, and they're a force that are busy withdrawing at the moment. So how safe do Malians feel about having an election on the 28th of July? I'm not too sure. I'm not convinced they are.
Well, Alex, we'll look forward to keeping in touch with you as we get closer to those elections. Thank you for joining us today. That was Monocle's correspondent in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith.
Now, one of the most controversial and talked about documentaries of this year has brought to attention events in Indonesia almost 50 years ago, when more than a million people were murdered in an anti-communist cull after a failed coup. Filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer met some of the killers and discovered they felt no shame about what they'd done, and in fact were happy to talk about the murders, even bragging about them.
In his documentary Act of Killing, Oppenheimer goes beyond retelling the facts. He doesn't just interview the perpetrators, he also manages to get them to stage and reenact the killings in detail. Act of Killing has been welcomed by critics and received encouraging reviews. The film has been dubbed one of the most important of the year. Well, Monaco's Marcus Hippie met the director, Joshua Oppenheimer.
When you read all the reviews of this documentary film, one word is being used all the time to describe your documentary, and the word is shocking. How do you see the documentary yourself?
The documentary is the result of an 8-year journey. What is shocking for a viewer has been my life for 8 years. I would say that I try not to read the reviews at all. I take note of them. I'm not such a strong soul that I can avoid doing that. But giving myself for a decade to working with the perpetrators and survivors of the Indonesian genocide was something I did because I encountered in Indonesia a situation that seemed so morally terrible that it exerted this hold on me. I come from a family that narrowly escaped the Holocaust, my father's family and my stepmother's family. Many died, in fact. And I went to Indonesia for something else and found myself in a community of survivors about a decade ago, survivors of the genocide. That's how I first heard of the genocide. And living all around them were the perpetrators who had killed their relatives. And the perpetrators were boasting openly about what they did. And the survivors were too scared to talk, decades on. And I had this feeling that it was as if the Nazis have won. It was as if you went into Germany now and it were still the Third Reich. Decades on, the country had killed everyone they wanted to kill and had rebuilt normal business relationships with all the countries they failed to conquer. And I had this feeling that it's an extraordinary opportunity to understand what happens when we as human beings build our normality on terror and on lies. But it's also, tragically, not the exception to the rule, but the rule itself. Most of our societies are built on episodes of mass violence where perpetrators win through the violence, seize power, and build a whole regime on the basis of mythologizing atrocity as something patriotic or heroic. It was Oscar Wilde who said that patriotism is the virtue of the vicious, and he's absolutely right. So I felt this was a really important and shocking situation, albeit one that is tragically all too normal, and I therefore gave these years of my life to it, and it's no longer shocking to me.
This documentary could be called a performance documentary. What makes it so striking is that you actually got these murderers. You got them talking about what they had done. You also got them to recreate, reenact the events and to demonstrate in detail how they killed people. How did you get the idea for this?
Well, to the extent that I use reenactment and dramatization in the film, it wasn't a method to lure these men to open up or even to go into detail. I started filming with the perpetrators after it became too dangerous to film with the survivors. And then the survivors said, "Josh, don't quit. You must continue. Try filming the perpetrators. They will tell you what happened and they will boast about it. And in their boasting, the audience will see exactly why we're so afraid, the nature of the regime of fear that we live under. Because, of course, it is terrifying to live amongst the people who've killed your relatives and are boasting to you about how they did it because they're still in power, because they're still trying to justify it to themselves, and because they're trying to intimidate you as a survivor to not challenge their version of the events." So when I started filming with the perpetrators about 2 years before I met Anwar, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across the region. And I found that every perpetrator I could find was boasting, was open, was taking me to the places where they'd killed people, wanting to show me how they what they did in these very simple reenactments or demonstrations. Afterwards, they would complain that they hadn't thought to bring along a machete to use as a prop or friends to play victims. And I understood that in addition to what happened in 65, there was a huge story about impunity, about why are these men boasting now? How do they want to be seen? How do they think I see them? And how ultimately do they see themselves? So then, long before I met Anwar already, I was telling them, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. Your whole society is based on it. Your lives have been shaped by it. You want to show me what you've done. I want to understand what it means to you in your society. So therefore, go ahead and show me what you've done in whatever way you wish. And we'll put the reenactments together with the documentary footage of their making of and create a kind of new form of documentary, a documentary of the imagination, perhaps, rather than a documentary of everyday life. And that's what we did.
Anwar Kongo is indeed one of the main characters in this documentary. He could be accused for, what is the number, how many killings?
Perhaps 1,000. I once made a spreadsheet to try and verify that number based on how many people he said he killed in a given day. And it was rather higher than that. But to be modestly, I think we can guess 1,000.
And you spent a very long time working with him. How did your relationship with him evolve, and what is it like today?
I think when I first met him, I felt that I was entrusted with a work of historical and world historical and moral importance from a community of survivors and the bigger human rights community in Indonesia. And so I probably was looking to use his celebration of what he did as a way of exposing a regime of impunity. And I anticipated that he would be one of many killers. He was, in fact, the 41st perpetrator with whom I filmed. I approached the project as an expose, and therefore I probably had a certain distance. As I lingered on him, because his pain was close to the surface, and I started to see him as a human being, a grandfather, a man who was struggling to live with what he did, my relationship to him changed. I realized I must not flinch, and I must allow myself to get as close to him as I possibly can as a human being and go as deep as possible into the horror of what he's done, while at the same time never for a second suspending my moral judgment of his actions. And that was very painful. It meant there's a final third of the film where he goes deep into the horrors, the atrocities that he committed and into his own nightmares. And it was brutal. It was brutal to film. It was terrible to film. It was overwhelming. No matter how much I, as a filmmaker, tried to remain in control as an artist of what we were filming and how we would put it together, it was all of us involved with the film were sort of overcome by the force of this. It was like a tsunami overtaking us. And I know that gave me nightmares for a period of months, and then insomnia because I was afraid of the nightmares. It was a really painful journey, and in the end, Anwar and I, though, remain close, and he remains. I can't say I like Anwar, but I have a love for him as a person, as a human being who's been honest with me and who shared a very painful part of his experience very honestly. And I think he and I remain in touch, and he's been loyal to the film ever since he's seen it.
In a way, this documentary film is definitely one of the darkest ones I've seen in my life. Is there any light in it?
I think the film, in fact, has a happy ending. It may be the darkest happy ending that we can remember in cinema, but the fact that at the end of the film, Anwar somehow recognizes who he is, what he's done, what he's forced to, perhaps. But I think the whole motor behind his dramatizations, the increasingly surreal and elaborate dramatizations, the whole motor behind that is, in fact, his conscience. He feels that what he did was wrong unconsciously, and instead of admitting it, he's trying to escape from it by suggesting more and more elaborate embellishments, if you like. And so it's not a surprise, though, that if the motor of those embellishments, these dramatic embellishments, is his own conscience, it's not a surprise that the reenactments themselves become the prism through which he finally recognizes his own broken image.
The massacre has been a taboo in Indonesia, and actually your documentary film has been shown in the country now quite a few times during the last few months. Do you think it's going to change the way people in Indonesia see their history?
The act of killing has been shown as of April 1st, and since then we've lost track over 500 times in 95 cities with screenings as large as 600, 700, 800 people. So the act of killing is being seen widely. We're going to make the film available for free download to everybody in Indonesia, but I would say that the act of killing has already helped catalyze a sea change in how Indonesians are talking about their past. It's come to Indonesia like the child in the emperor's new clothes, pointing at the king and saying, look, the king is naked. And everybody knew it. Everybody was too afraid to say it. But once it's been said so powerfully, so emotionally, by the perpetrators themselves, there's really no going back.
That was Joshua Oppenheimer, director of Act of Killing, speaking to Monocle's own Marcus Hippie there. The film is out in cinemas now.
Past 8 in London. In the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be bringing you a taste of tonight's edition of Culture with Robert Bound, and we'll head live to Hungary to hear why that country's Prime Minister may be mopping his brow in relief. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Clemmie. Officials in Arizona say at least 19 firefighters have been killed while battling a wildfire around 80 miles northwest of Phoenix. It's the highest death toll for firefighters in a single incident since the 9/11 terror attacks in 2001. The United States is under pressure to respond to reports that it's been spying on EU offices in America. Citing papers leaked by the whistleblower Edward Snowden, the German magazine Der Spiegel is claiming that offices in New York and Washington were targeted, along with the French, German and Italian embassies. Croatia has become the 28th member of the European Union. Their membership began at midnight on Sunday, with huge crowds joining celebrations in the streets of the capital, Zagreb. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has been meeting his Southeast Asian counterparts at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Conference in Brunei. Mr. Kerry says the US is in favour of introducing a code of conduct to cover regional disputes. Demonstrators clashed with police outside Rio de Janeiro's Maracanã Stadium last night, where the Confederations Cup final between Brazil and Spain was being played. Inside the stadium, Brazil beat the reigning world champion Spain 3-0. A Chinese bank has taken first place in a survey of the world's top 1,000 banks. The annual survey by The Banker placed the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China at the top of the list. China now has 4 banks in the top 10 and 96 in the top 1,000. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Poppy Trowbridge.
In this week's episode of Culture, we have a live session from Finland's Sansa. We head to Berlin to watch a bit of opera performed in someone's sitting room, and we speak to acclaimed director Mike Figgis about his new film.
But in our Culture preview coming up right now, we're meeting up with artist Ryan Gander. He lives and works between London and Saxmundham on England's East Anglian coast. He wants to start a brand new world-class art school in a former schoolhouse there. Culture's own Robert Bound went to Ryan's studio in East London to find out more.
Please wait, your call is in progress.
Hello, Ryan.
Call from door panel.
Hi, we've come to visit Ryan Gander in his secret underground lair.
Someone has
It's basically to give six artists the opportunity to become professional artists, self-sustaining artists, so they don't have to teach and do other jobs. They can, you know, make their money and their living at making arts, which is what I do, which is like an incredibly privileged position to be in, I think. So there's six of them there at any one time, and they stay 5 months and they get like a studio. Then there's communal facilities, you know, workshops, there's a cafe open to the public, a gallery, a library, project space, a glass-covered courtyard, which is like a forum for lectures and debates and things. And then there's a, it's all one building built on two courtyards, and attached to it there's a an accommodation block. And the rooms in that, there'll be 16 rooms, so that the participants can live there, but then there's extra rooms for advisors to come and stay and, you know, do a day's talking and then stay for supper prepared by the participants. But also then there's enough room for smaller projects, like maybe some graphic designers from the Netherlands come over and do a project, or curators from a curating course, or, and it's very free and open and up in the air, and it's really by, not even application, but just by a letter to the, you know, the direction of the...
Right.
And if it has artistic merit and the people who are asking for it are in real need of the opportunity, then it's granted. It's a bit like Art Heaven. These are the floor plans by the architects. We've got these two young architects working on it.
How finished are you thinking in your head the artists are going to be by the time they turn up to Saxmundham?
Yeah, well, I don't want them to have a profile. I want it to be open, so age shouldn't be a restriction, or previous education shouldn't be a restriction. It's basically based on two principles, and one is artistic excellence and the other is need. So it's not really for people who are financially able to carry on practicing on their own. It's for people who would end up in Allied Carpets in the next few weeks ordering deep shag.
Which is also a type of tobacco.
Yeah, it is, you're right.
Either, you don't want to get those two confused.
Say deep,
don't
pile,
smoke.
Deep pile. Deep pile. Differentiate. I've always wanted to set up an art school. I don't really know why. I think it's because when I was younger, I found myself working in Allied Carpets and ended up at a place called the Rijksacademie in Amsterdam, which was a sort of residency programme, a really good opportunity. You know, you got an allowance to live on, a place to live in, a studio, and technicians to help you and things like that. And I don't know, I've always felt a little bit indebted and guilty about it. I've always been interested in wanting to open, you know, some sort of residency programme or art school. And it's a pretty good time to do it now. Oh. There's a lot of people who enjoy collecting art, and they're very busy people, and they find it hard to find the times to go to all the art fairs and do the massive amount of research and da 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 da. And at this school, over a 10-year period, we'll have 120 artists going through it. So my idea was to ask each of these artists to make a piece of work that they thought was representative of their stay, their 6 months at the school. And that would go into it, they'd gift it to the Fairfield International. This is the school. And it would become part of the Fairfield International Legacy Collection. And then those 120 works we could swap for the cost of, because the build cost of the school is quite high, because it's a good school. All things cost money. Some things cost more money when they're really good. The idea is that it's a ready-built collection that could be traded for currency, and the currency would produce the school. But the nice thing about that is it's almost like, it's not just a collection, it's a collection that is the history of 10 years of the school. And effectively, the collector is buying something that doesn't exist yet. So by buying something that they haven't seen, there's that leap of faith and that belief as well. So it echoes really well with the whole concept of the school. And of course, there's a nice economy to it, because the collector that decides to give the money for the 120 works that aren't made yet, they're also, by giving the money, investing in the artists that will make the works, and therefore they're investing in the value of their own collection that doesn't exist yet. It sounds like Back to the Future, doesn't it?
It does sound like Back to the Future. I love the idea of this. This is the kind of thing that could, this is the school that could only be set up by a successful practicing artist, though. Knowing the connections between the value of your work, the market or your own belief in your work, the kind of market value, as it were, and having a network of collectors and the gallery thing and all the rest of it. This is presumably, it's things like this, it's Venn diagrams in your head like this, that are the things that aspiring artists don't yet know, but that what they'll learn at the school as well, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of experience and knowledge, really, that's built up, isn't it? I mean, we all know that our education in the UK is a bit messed up at the moment, and it'll be impossible for anyone without money to ever go to art school soon. And it's all well and good, you know, waving placards and protesting, but actually, if there's a problem with something, it's much better just to do something, isn't it? Something positive and make something happen rather than moan about what's not happening. And you can do things like guerrilla tactics, but I also think, because I have this knowledge of the inside and the economies and the systems that are at play within the art world and in education, it's better just to do it from the inside out, you know, and use this system that already exists to make the best possible situation for artists.
That was Ryan Gander there telling Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound about his plans to create a world-class art college here on the East Anglian coast. You can catch the latest episode of Culture with Robert Bound at 1900 London time.
Meanwhile, you're listening to Midori House. The time has just gone 8:41 here in London. We'll be back right after this with our man in Budapest.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle.
In Hong Kong.
I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keep you an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:42 here in London. Also time to hear from one of Monocle's correspondents on the ground around the world. And today it's our man in Budapest, Adam Labor. Welcome to you, Adam.
Good morning.
Well, today we start with, depending on how you want to look at it, a lucky escape for Hungary or a vote of confidence. Tell us what's just happened here with this vote.
Well, the Council of Europe has voted not to put Hungary under supervision. And the backstory to this is that since the government came to power in 2010 with a two-thirds majority, it centralized political power here to a degree we haven't seen before. And there's been a lot of concerns about the state of democracy in Hungary. Now, the government says we want a two-thirds majority for radical change, so that's what we're doing. But human rights organizations and the Council of Europe itself have had a lot of worries about Hungary, especially the constitution, which has been changed four or five times since the new constitution was brought in. So there was a lot of pressure on the Council of Europe about this, but it seems that Hungary has escaped, which is a big victory for Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister.
It would have been an extraordinary embarrassment for Hungary, which has after all been a member of the EU for nearly 10 years. Many people are saying that his approach, though, or the approach of the government, has been not near Orwellian. I mean, recently they passed that national security law, which allows for greater surveillance of government officials. That includes reading emails, tapping phones, having their homes bugged. That certainly sounds Orwellian. Do you think that they've got away with it, essentially?
I think at this stage they've got away with it. The next question is what happens in the European Parliament, which is probably going to happen this week. There was a report written by the European Parliament, which is different to the Council of Europe, the European Parliament of the European Union, by a Portuguese MEP called Tavares. And the Tavares report is extremely critical of Hungary. It was approved by the European Parliament's Human Rights and Civil Liberties Committee, and now it's going to the full Parliament. Now, if the full parliament votes to accept that, then that's a big blow to the government. But if the parliament doesn't vote to accept it, then again, it's a big boost to the government here. So we're playing for high stakes now.
Adam, in the footnotes, the council did note these serious and sustained concerns, they say, pledging to closely follow the situation in Hungary. Is that going to keep them on the straight and narrow? Does that really mean anything?
I don't think it means very much. I think, you know, you can be concerned and you can monitor, but the point is what's happening with the votes and what's happening with the procedures and the consequences. So there are no real consequences. So, you know, I mean, and frankly, the Council of Europe is not a body that most people have even heard of. They get it muddled up with the European Commission, which is part of the European Union. So, you know, being monitored by the Council of Europe is not really going to set them trembling in the Hungarian Parliament.
Adam, let's move over to protests that have been happening against a refugee centre that's being opened in the West Hungarian village, which seems slightly ironic given Hungary's own refugee history. But tell us more about this.
Well, yes, Hungary is a transit point for a lot of people smuggling and people trafficking because the Romanian-Hungarian border is the Schengen border. So once you get into Hungary, then you're free to go anywhere. You know, you're free to go to Portugal, to go to Scandinavia without any border checks. So a lot of refugees are coming through here. And the question is, well, what do you do with them? I mean, you can't put them in prison and you have to treat them humanely. So you need some refugee centres. Now, there's a plan to open one to hold a couple of hundred people in Western Hungary, and it's provoked a lot of very noisy demonstrations against it. But I think Hungarians are forgetting that, you know, throughout Hungarian history, especially in the 20th century, there have been hundreds of thousands of Hungarian refugees after the failed revolution of 1956. More than 200,000 Hungarians fled, and they were refugees to Austria and on to Canada and Italy and Britain and the United States. So I would hope that Hungarians could remember that a bit when they think more, you know, think a little bit more about that when they're dealing with the comparatively small numbers of refugees coming in here now.
Adam, do you mind if we make you the topic of our next story? You've got a new book out. Tell us about it, please.
Well, I've got a... thank you, yes. I won't be too modest, so yeah, I don't mind. I've got a thriller out. It's called The Geneva Option, and it's a conspiracy thriller set in the United Nations. And the heroine is a woman. Her name is Yael Azulay, and she does the dirty deals behind the scenes that keep diplomacy and big business rolling. She's like the secret fixer.
She's so badass, she's by the sounds of it. I love the sound of
that. She is. But she's also quite sensitive and quite vulnerable, you know, because she's a woman in her mid-30s, and she hasn't got really anyone in her life apart from her job, and she's wondering what it all means and where's it all going.
Uh-oh, Adam. What was the inspiration for this character?
Well, I think the inspiration was probably a lot of people that I've met over the years, you know, career women, women journalists, women aid workers.
That's what I was afraid of, Adam. That's what I was afraid of.
Not so much journalists, and certainly not Monocle radio presenters. But but I met a lot of women at the UN. You know, I was a reporter in Bosnia in Yugoslavia covering the war, so I had quite a lot to do with United Nations. And I can see that you can get really sucked into that organisation, and they call them UN widows because, you know, you get well paid. It's good work, you're doing important work, and it's quite prestigious and glamorous and travelling. And then you sort of hit 40 and you think, oh,
where's my life gone?
Yeah, where's my life gone? I've got lots of clothes and money in the bank, but...
lots of stories to tell. Well, I mean, fantastic article also written in the New York Times by you this weekend about how you go from being a journalist to a thriller writer. Well, in fact, the leap, as you say, is not actually massive. Scratch a journalist, you write, especially a foreign correspondent, and more often than not, you'll find a frustrated thriller writer. Well, you, Adam Labor, most definitely not a frustrated thriller writer, just knocking them out of the park every time. I can't wait to read this next one, I must say. Thank you so much for joining us here on the show. Monocle's correspondent in Budapest, Adam Labor, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again very shortly. You're listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Poppy Trowbridge.
Before we start our Brazilian paper review, we have to say that Brazilians will be celebrating today because they have won the Confederations Cup against Spain last night. And so, to celebrate with us a Brazilian classic by Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66, this is País Tropical.
The dulcet tones of Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66 there, following Brazil's victory at the Confederations Cup final in Rio de Janeiro. And no more an appropriate introduction either than for our newspaper reviewer today here on Midori House, Monocle's very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who is wearing the colours of his country's flag. He's been celebrating since 2 o'clock in the morning. Welcome to you, Fernando.
Welcome, and I'm very happy. You know, and I just chose this song because Brazil won, because if we lost, we wouldn't be playing this song.
You always say to me, football is on the front page, and how are they telling the world about their victory today?
Well, just look at the front page of O Globo, you know, there's a clear provocation against the Spanish. Olé, you know, because, you know, they love saying that. But actually, I was watching the match, and people were not so sure that the Brazilian team would win, actually. But then, basically, it was a thrilling match. Brazil performed incredibly well. And, you know, Spain is, you know, they won the Euro Cup, they won the last World Cup, and they're considered possibly the best team nowadays. But I'm not so sure anymore, you know.
Can't
sorry.
Beat Brazil.
As you can see, there's a lovely picture of Neymar with his arms wide open.
Very lovely picture. I'm happy to look at that all day long, let me tell you. So they were playing to a crowd of almost 75,000 at the new Maracana Stadium. Big deal there.
Big deal there. And you know, there was a lot of worries. Would the stadiums be ready? And actually, in terms of infrastructure, everything worked pretty well. Yeah. You know that Brazil will have this massive wave of protests that actually coincide to happen during the same time as the Confederations Cup. And you know, Brazilians are indeed a little bit angry about the way FIFA and the Brazilian government spend money with stadiums, which is quite expensive. So yesterday there was also like a peaceful protest outside Maracanã of about 5,000 people. So the protest continues, you know, because in the past it was well known that if Brazil won the World Cup, people would forget about their problems.
Yeah.
But I think Brazil is changing somehow. Of course we're happy. All my friends are happy, but that doesn't mean that the protests will be over.
Doesn't mean that they're satisfied with the status quo.
Exactly. So,
and even a football victory can't trump everything.
Absolutely.
That is the change for Brazil.
That is a big change. I think after the protests, I see like a new country. Which is quite interesting. And then that's, I can go for our second story, which is from Folha de São Paulo as well, which of course they mentioned the match, you know, like everybody's happy. But then they did the first opinion polls for the presidential and the governor elections for next year.
Some shocking numbers there, some shocking change in the numbers.
Exactly. And actually, they even mentioned that we never seen such a big change. Because before the protest, just a week before the protest started, Dilma had 56% of approval rate. Dilma Rousseff, which actually she didn't attend at the final because she was scared that she would be booed because she was at the opening match. And every time she said something, the crowd booed.
Fernando, is this change in numbers, the poll saying, down to the way she's handled these protests? Or is it just an awakening on behalf of the people that she's mismanaged the economy over her time in power?
I think both, you know, because she did give like a speech on national TV, but it was a little bit too late. And at the same time, she didn't say she did something wrong. She just said, I understand your voice and I'll do something. But it was not very convincing, you know.
Is there an obvious demographic shift, though, in terms of who still supports her and who's turning their affection elsewhere?
Absolutely. You know, she managed to keep, now she has 30% of the vote. She managed to keep the vote with the over 60s and in the poorest regions of Brazil, like the Northeast, which, you know, she started at, well, Lula's government as well, the Bolsa Família, which is some sort of welfare state, which really helped the poorest in Brazil. But now among the richest and among the young, Marina Silva, which is in second place overall, 23%, she's actually beating Dilma on that. And it's interesting to analyze because in those demographics between the young and the rich, if they start supporting someone, the others will follow. That's at least the trend if you see the previous Brazilian elections.
And how much do sort of the population go in for these polls? If they start to see Marina gaining popularity, is there going to be any kind of call for change in government before the big events coming up?
Absolutely.
That could be very destabilizing.
Exactly. And if they see, okay, oh, Marina Silva is doing well, so maybe, because some people, they wouldn't vote for Marina saying she would never have the chance to win an
it
election.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, a snowball
exactly.
effect.
Exactly. And it's not only Marina Silva, we have Joaquim Barbosa, which is our Supreme Court judge, and he did he did like fought against corruption very heavily, and Brazilians loved him. They even wear his mask during Carnival this year.
Why do they love him? Where's his popularity?
Because he judged this main salon, which was kind of this terrible corruption scandal in Brazil where MPs, they paid money for their projects to be approved. But then he said, oh, this should not be allowed, and he was very vocal against corruption. And so basically Brazilians loved him, and he's quite, he's, how can I say, he's very media friendly, I would say, as well. So
a bit of charm.
Exactly. Mm. So, and charm always win an election, not only in Brazil, I think worldwide.
It does help, doesn't it?
So yeah, that's quite interesting things. And but also I want to end on a happy note. You know, in Rio, actually, they're mentioned on Globo that the city is growing more than double the average of the Brazilian growth, and even the GDP per capita in Rio. So at the same time, there's the good side of those events as well.
And they
so
found
it's not
oil,
all bad news.
Oil off the shores.
Exactly. So. Oil, football, you know, Olympics.
What
come
more
on.
Could you want?
Come on. You know, it's not all bad. It's not all bad. Let's end on this positive note, I have
and
to say.
And let's win the World Cup and then we can really all be happy.
Let's do that.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, wonderful to see you as always. Here on the on Midori House. That's all we have time for today, sadly. Thanks very much to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Fernando. Here he is in the studio with us, and Tess McCann, our studio manager. Up next, after the news, is The Urbanist. Phil Han and Dominic Reynolds will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Clemency Burton-Hill.
And from me, Poppy Trowbridge. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.